Hey guys, it's Adriana. There's only a few days left to pre-order Red Pilled America's first ever book, Awakenings. Please join us in fighting the culture war by reserving your copy today. Visit redpilledamerica.com right now and click on the book to reserve yours and support the show. And please be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're receiving it and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Thanks.
This episode includes depictions of violence and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised.
We looked at all these different houses, and then we found the one in Carson.
Previously on Red Pilled America.
We came home with the police at the house.
Someone had broken in.
Coming home and your house is torn apart.
While Dad was out celebrating his birthday, a man broke into the house while we were there.
They start singing this song to me. Black is beautiful, white is funky. If you don't believe me, ask a white honky.
What does the black community need to do to finally overcome the legacy of slavery?
I surrender all to thee, my blessed Savior. I surrender all.
This is part two of The Minority. You've probably already heard part one, but if you haven't, stop and go back to the beginning and listen to the first of this two-part series. We're searching for the answer to the question, what does the black community need to do to finally overcome the legacy of slavery? To find the answer, we're telling the story of a family that had to endure years of targeted racism. To start where we left off, on one morning in December 1982, just a few days before Christmas, I woke up and my mom wasn't there. That never happened. Never. My dad told me that she'd went to visit my Aunt Marianne, but even as a preteen, I sensed something was wrong. So later that morning, while my sister and I were walking with a group of friends to a park across the street from our elementary school, I asked her where she thought Mom went. And that's when she told me what happened. I've been thinking a lot about how to tell this story, and perhaps more importantly, why I'd even want to share such an incredibly personal and trying time for our family. It can be emotionally taxing and make one feel exposed, even vulnerable, as this story admittedly has at times. I discussed it with Adriana, my mom and sister, and also dug through some of my old journals to review some of my thoughts on this era throughout the years. And what I gathered is, for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to tell the story of what our family endured over nearly a decade-long span of my childhood in Carson. The first real short story that I ever wrote was in my 9th grade English class with Mrs. Nazon, and the story I told was about this very phase in my life. So why, since my freshman year in high school, have I felt compelled to talk about our Carson experience? The conclusion I came to is that it's a story that is rarely told. The number of movies about white racism against blacks seems endless. Mississippi Burning, To Kill a Mockingbird, Hidden Figures, 12 Years a Slave, The Help, Get Out, Django Unchained, The Color Purple, 42, The Butler, Fruitvale Station, Driving Miss Daisy, Selma, The Birth of a Nation, Black Klansman. The list goes on and on and on. But can you name one movie that addresses the reverse? Try to come up with a single film that tackles black racism towards whites in a negative light. Go ahead and name one, just one. You can't. Why is that? Why have Hollywood and the mainstream media and our literary industry stayed away from that topic? I think I know the answer, and we'll get to that before the end of this episode. but I knew from a very young age that this lived experience was incredibly important to share because of the powerful lesson that can be extracted from it. A lesson that our cultural gatekeepers do not want Americans to contemplate. What we lived through in Carson, the racial slurs, the property damage, the terrorizing, was too much for any family to endure. But what happened on that night in December 1982 was something different, something even darker. To this day, we only refer to it with two words.
The incident.
The incident.
On that night, my dad went out to celebrate his birthday, leaving my mom, sister, baby brother, and I home alone. Us kids were asleep when a man broke into the house.
I just remember waking up to hearing mom like just scream really fast and just like a, you know, and like she got scared.
But I just remember him running up behind me and slamming me from behind, like almost knocking the wind out of me. And I'm off the ground.
I just opened my eyes and I remember our bunk bed was like facing the hallway. And there was a light on in the living room, so it lit up the hallway. And then I see mom get dragged to her room by a guy. He had an afro with a hat. And it wasn't completely sitting on his head very well. And it was just so surreal for me. I'm like, am I dreaming? Is this? So I just kind of laid there and I could just hear her crying. And I just remember laying there and thinking, I was terrified. I mean, I was in shock.
My mom's yelp didn't wake me up, nor my baby brother. For years, I wished it had. The guilt over that issue stayed with me well into my adulthood. But as a father now, knowing the difference in strength between a man and a prepubescent boy, well, perhaps it was a good thing that I didn't wake up. I was 12. My sister 10, my brother 3. We didn't own a gun. I was probably in no place to challenge that savage. At least that's the way I like to think about it now.
And see, and that was my biggest fear, is I didn't want him to hurt the kids. And so, then got into the bedroom, and then we got to the bedroom, and I thought, fuck, this is not going to happen. I said, my kids are in the other room. Didn't matter. My husband's just went to the store. He's going to be right back. Picks me up, drags me to the front door, bolts the door, goes back in, and does his thing. And then left.
And then I saw him again run out of the of the hallway, run out of the room.
And then I could hear him running. So I knew he wasn't in a car.
I mean, I don't even know how long I laid there for. I have no idea how long whatever the incident went on for.
I just wanted to curl up in a ball as a young woman, to me, I was going to fight it off. There was nobody ever going to be able to do that to me because I was going to fight it off. I'd die first. When it's happening and your kids are in the other room and the fear and the paranoia sets in, your body locks. It locks and can't. And that's how I pretty much was when he got home.
So I'm laying there and then mom gets up and she's crying and dad comes home from wherever.
And he came to the door and knocked on it and then wondered why I had locked it, and then I told him what happened.
And she proceeds to tell him, as she's telling him about it, she's closing our bedroom door, but she's telling him what just happened to her, how she was raped, and as she's closing the door. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this really happened.
Mom was, of course, shook to the core. So she left that night to stay at my Aunt Marianne and Uncle Randy's place.
And so I went there and stayed for a couple of days. I was not in any shape to be around the kids or anything like that.
The next morning, when I asked my sister about where she thought mom was, she told me what happened the night before, and I was floored.
I know that you were curious. I'm not sure what they told us why she was gone, But I knew. And then as we're walking to school, that's when I told you, I think this is what happened.
Denise hadn't yet told anyone what she saw. So when Mom returned home a few days later, I let her know that Denise got a good look at the guy.
Then you told Mom. I didn't want to tell Mom because I was just, it was just so scary, you know? I didn't want to talk about it anymore. I wanted to tell you. I wanted you to know. And then I just wanted it to go away because it was just such a scary, horrible experience. And so I remember you told Mom, and then she asked me about it. And I said, yes, I saw. That's exactly. And I told her the exact same story.
But what none of us knew at the time was that law enforcement had already known about this monster well before my mom filed a police report. More after the break. Welcome back. So I told my mom that my sister Denise had seen the man that attacked her. But what we didn't know was that law enforcement had known about this monster well before my mom filed a police report.
So finally it was a few days later, and then I reported it and went down to the police station. My friend Suzanne went with me, and they had profiles and everything by then. I was the 13th victim. One woman had been raped twice. Her husband would go out of town for a week or 2 weeks at a time.
Carson had a sexual predator on its hands. After talking to all the victims, the police department created a profile on this sicko. He was a young black man of average height. Because he ran away on foot, they suspected he didn't have a car or was local. He also had a unique characteristic. He had Asian-looking eyes. I guess it's in our blood to be proactive, because I remember Mom searching for this sicko herself, venturing into uncharted areas of the neighborhood.
And we drove down streets that we'd lived there our whole, you know, childhood for years, and we're driving down streets that we had never been down. You know, we were starting to get deep.
In hindsight, it was understandable. She wanted to catch this animal. And given the experience that we had with police in Carson, we didn't trust that they'd find the guy. But in parallel, law enforcement began to hone in on a potential suspect, a young black man in his early 20s living in our neighborhood, only a few blocks away from our home. Just a couple weeks into the new year, law enforcement began to stake out his house, carefully watching the property. At some point, they decided it was time to make a move and bring him in for questioning. But coincidentally, just as they swarmed the house, his younger brother, an 18-year-old young black man, was riding up on his bike. He had Asian-looking eyes. When he saw the commotion, he thought the police were in fact coming for him. So he turned around and bolted down the street on his bike. But the police took chase and caught him. And once they did, they began drilling down, not on the initial 20-something guy at the residence, but instead on his 18-year-old brother. It wasn't long after the arrest that Mom got a call from my aunt.
Mary Jo called, and she said, "They arrested somebody." It was in the Daily Breeze. You know, and she read me the article.
The police eventually called my mom and asked if her and my sister would come down to try and identify the sicko in a police lineup.
Well, I remember I didn't want to. I was terrified. I did not know. You know, we didn't have access to a internet to kind of see what a lineup is all about. I was so scared to go down because I had no idea what to expect. You know, was this guy going to be in the same room as us? Is he going to be able to see me? Is he going to, you know, I had no idea what to expect. So I was terrified. I just remember I just couldn't eat that day and I just did not want to go. But, you know, Mom was just like, you know, do this for me. You know, you're going to be fine. We're safe. We're going to be at the police station. We'll be fine.
So Mom and Denise went down to the station with the 12 other women that were attacked.
All I remember is he was number 4. I do remember the exact, you know, everybody stepped forward. They, you know, took turns stepping forward. And then when he stepped forward, I just said, "Oh my gosh, it's number 4. That's number 4. And so apparently Mom and I picked out the same guy. I found this out later.
But it wasn't over for them yet.
I remember I had to testify in court too. which was terrifying, because when they asked me my name, I couldn't even say my name. I was so scared, and you know, because he's sitting right there in court. He's sitting right across the room from me, you know. I remember the judge had me say my name, and I sat there for a minute, and I'm like, what is my name? And so then when the prosecutor told me to point him out, you know, I'm like, okay, can I point to him without looking? Will I point at the right person? You know, just use your peripheral vision and just point without looking at him, you know? And I had to look at him and point at him. And that was just terrifying, because after that, like, just, I don't even remember anything. I don't remember walking out of the court. I don't remember anything I said after that.
But Mom remembers what the prosecutor asked my sister.
What do you recognize about him? And she goes, well, he had like Chinese eyes. And the prosecutor was Chinese or Asian of some descent, which that kind of like cracked everybody up and stuff.
And I just wanted to get out of there. I wanted it all to be over. I was so, you know, bothered that I had to, you know, that I witnessed this.
The man was convicted and was sentenced for little over a decade in prison, which seems like a paltry amount for a clearly incurable sick young man. Does anyone think that someone capable of viciously raping 13 women can ever be rehabilitated? After the incident and through the trial, the status quo remained. We were still prisoners in our own home, largely unable to go outside other than to get in our car and leave. Everyone wanted to move. That is, everyone except my father.
He didn't want to move. He wanted to stay, period. That was all there was to it.
Weeks turned into months until Dad slipped right back into his old ways, frequently leaving us home alone at night. As desperately as my mom tried to keep the family together, this couldn't go on any longer. Something had taken a hold of our father. His childhood traumas caught up with him and sparked the beginnings of a very long, dark journey with addiction. My mom had had enough. She kicked him out of the house and immediately put it up for sale. Mom began looking to move us back to her hometown.
I remember going house hunting in Torrance and just being so excited.
The houses that we looked at was a cute three-bedroom in North Torrance. The backyard had a playhouse with carpet and a working light. It was modest, but larger than our Carson home, and compared to what we'd endured for nearly a decade, it was a little slice of heaven. So Mom bought the place. I remember our Uncle Pat coming over and helping us pack up and move out of the Carson house. Others joined in as well. It was sad that we were leaving our friends Heather and Maurice behind, really the only bright spot of that neighborhood. But we were all ready to put that place behind us forever.
And I just remember just saying to myself, I'm never going back there again.
The day that we moved into our new Torrance home was incredible. The feeling of freedom was indescribable.
It was a dream. It was just a glorious dream. It was just such a glorious day. Lord, was I happy that day came and we were able to go to a school that we could walk to and we could play outside. And we didn't even really have a curfew on the weekend. I mean, Mom still wanted us home before it got dark, but we were actually able to like ride our bikes up the street. We could leave our bikes in the driveway and them not be stolen in 30 seconds while we went and got some water in the house. I just remember it being glorious and just so happy to get out of there and just, you know, have a normal life like my friends did when I would go to my friend's house and go play outside.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was such, mm-hmm. that feeling was just like, it was incredible. I just, mm-hmm. and I remember getting on my bike and riding around town. I remember I rode over to that, I think it's called Hamilton, the baseball field and the church over there. And I rode in that parking lot over there by the church. And I just remember feeling like, God, I felt free. I felt free.
Yeah, I said, we could have a normal childhood. We can ride around on our bikes, and we can walk around. There was cork liquor right there that we'd go get candy, and, you know, and we didn't have to walk you know, in groups and worry about, you know, all that, and have mom stand there at the front door and watch us wherever we walked, you know. So it was just a glorious day.
As incredible as it was for Denise, Casey, and I, it was a struggle for mom. She was now going it alone, with a mortgage payment triple what it was in Carson.
So you talk about poor.
How are you able to afford that?
I worked every single minute I could. I did the crafting jobs. I did all of that kind of stuff to bring in that extra money. And it helped a lot.
Yeah.
Babysat. I did everything I could to make money. We drove old cars. We ate cheap. We never took any vacations except camping.
Yeah.
Think about it. Never.
As the years went by, we had our struggles, including with our father. But we weren't under siege like in Carson. Torrance was ethnically diverse. Hispanics, Japanese, Koreans, Filipinos, Hawaiians, whites, and blacks. That's what made up our group of friends. Mom always instilled in us the idea that our experience in Carson did not represent the black community as a whole. Even with the brutality of the situation, prejudice never took hold of her or her kids' souls. I asked Mom recently about how we were able to avoid building any racial animosity after our experience in Carson. What I'm trying to get to is that I never felt any animosity
towards
the black
race.
People.
Right.
I just didn't.
Either. No, I didn't either.
And I don't know how that we were able to avoid that.
I think because you had enough good people in your life, and good black people in your life, and good minorities, and good majorities, and you know, a mixture of cultures, that you're going to school in Gardena, you had all the mixture of cultures there, and I think that we compartmentalized that as incidences, not as black on white, but as something that happened when we lived in this neighborhood that was not a good neighborhood. And it wasn't so much that it was a black neighborhood, it was just not a good neighborhood to be in.
Mom continued to teach us to stay connected to the black community. Unlike most non-black families, in many ways, black culture was our culture. In our formative years, we lived in an all-black neighborhood, taking in the music, the attitude, the culture. Even though over time we were shunned by the neighborhood, we understood the black experience personally. Throughout the years, people have told me, oddly, that they thought I was black. One black man that I met even said that he sensed, quote, a hint of tint in me. Carson was in the rearview mirror, but it wasn't totally out of sight. However, one event in particular seemed to bring our entire Carson experience to a close.
The jury in the Rodney King case has delivered its verdict, and not one of the four police officers seen on videotape beating Mr. King a year ago is guilty of using excessive force. They've all been found not guilty.
Chief Gates has put aside $1 million fund to pay for overtime for 1,000 police officers who have been placed on alert following this verdict. Peter?
Judith, you know your city pretty well. The fact that those police officers have been put on alert anticipates a reaction to a not guilty verdict?
I don't think there's much doubt that there's going to be quite a reaction. I think this was a stunning verdict.
More after the break.
Hey, everyone. We're on a mission to publish our first book of short stories, but we need your help.
Storytelling is one of the most effective ways to convey ideas and change hearts and minds. It's so powerful that out of all the things the Obamas could have done after leaving the White House, they've decided to become professional storytellers.
Storytelling is also a method used to pass down our shared history, but put into the wrong hands, like for example the Obamas, and history can be rewritten. Here's the good news. Red Pilled America is fighting back by telling our side of the story, otherwise known as the truth.
And we've decided to publish those stories in our first ever book entitled Awakenings, a compilation of American stories about moments of truth. We've chosen some of the best stories from the show for the book, along with a few new stories.
Maybe you have a friend you've been wanting to red pill. This could make an excellent Christmas gift for them. Or get one for yourself and enjoy. It's time for us to come together and fight back.
But we need your help.
Visit redpilledamerica.com today and click on the book icon at the top of the site to pre-order your book. Let's finally take back the culture and have our voices heard.
Thanks everyone. Welcome back. So Carson was in the rearview mirror, but it wasn't totally out of sight. However, one event in particular seemed to bring our entire Carson experience to a close.
The violence erupted after the acquittal of four white policemen in the beating trial of black motorist Rodney King. There's been looting, buildings have been set ablaze, and some motorists have been dragged from their cars and beaten. So far, 9 people are reported dead, scores of others have been injured, and Governor Pete Wilson has declared a state of emergency today, Thursday, April the 30th.
The LA riots hit in 1992. It was a surreal time. You have to have lived in Los Angeles to truly understand it, but the week that followed gave a quick glimpse at how quickly society can break down into complete chaos. With the dust barely settled, Mom wanted to do her part to help the black community. About a week after the tragic events, it was Mother's Day.
We were like, where do you want to go? And she wanted to go to South Central.
I would have to go through the area that had been burnt for my job, so I knew of an AME church there, and then I also knew, you know, people from work that were familiar with that area. I felt comfortable because I had to drive through those neighborhoods to work. I knew where you had to be careful, you know, and I knew you don't go down an alley unless you have to, or those kind of things. But I felt very comfortable in the neighborhoods as a general rule, driving up and down the streets and stuff like that. I didn't feel uncomfortable doing that.
And having lived in Carson for all those years, it prepares you a bit for tough neighborhoods.
And we just decided to take the money that we would have spent on a Mother's Day, anything that we would have done on Mother's Day, and go and buy, you know, stuff and donate groceries and stuff like that. So we went to the market and everybody spent what they were going to spend on Mother's Day in the store.
And we bagged it all up and headed for the church Mom identified in South Central.
And so we took food to them.
But when we arrived, there was a bit of unease. The organizers at the church had a hint of concern for us in their eyes.
I just remember them being nervous when we, not nervous,
well, they
but
were
kind
like,
of like.
They were unexpecting us. They weren't expecting us. It was like, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was like, okay, the milk goes over there and all the canned good goes over there and then, okay. You know, and they just, it was like it was not a safe environment.
They were obviously concerned for our safety, but all in all, it was an unforgettable experience.
And it just felt so good. Didn't it feel like, wow, you know, this is something we should do all the time and not just for a Mother's Day gift, because it just felt so good to help people.
It was incredibly rewarding. For some reason, it felt like through that moment of giving back on Mother's Day, we were officially forgiving Carson for what that neighborhood did to us.
But you would think after something so traumatic like that, that happens to Mom, you would think that, you know, maybe sometimes people end up being, you know, a little racist after that, or, you know, harboring some serious bad feelings. And, you know, she didn't. We went to the root of it. We went to the heart of South Central there. And I mean, we were all exposed, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Which brings us back to the question, what does the black community need to do to finally overcome the legacy of slavery? Throughout my life, I've often thought back to our time in Carson and wondered why my name went so abruptly from Patrick to Honky with all the neighborhood kids. In the moment, I just didn't understand it. At my elementary school, no one ever called me that, and I'd say roughly about 25% of the student body was black. But for some reason, just one city over, amongst kids I'd known and played with for years, my name became a racial slur. Then about 10 years ago, Adriana and I began touring elementary schools to send our daughter to, and at one school, we dropped into a second grade class as part of the tour. I was immediately struck by what they were being taught. They were learning about the water fountain for, quote, the colored people. Why in the hell are they teaching kids about this at such a young age? I thought. It brought me back to a time in my elementary school years when we too were taught about racism. In 1977, the miniseries Roots aired. Although it claimed to be a true story at the time, it was later discovered to be a fictional story about the journey of Kunta Kinte, a man who was enslaved in Africa and brought to America. The series was a brutal and graphic depiction of slavery, and debuted at a time when a popular TV show was watched by literally everyone. Many teachers began using the show as part of their lesson plans in elementary schools, including in one of my classes. There may have been some other effects, but I don't recall it creating any racial animosity on campus at the time. Likely because we were an ethnically diverse school. Everyone had relationships with people from other races. It felt like we were all in the same playing field. But in an all-black neighborhood like Carson, I could see how watching Roots could have a completely different effect. You may remember us talking to YouTube stars Diamond and Silk a while ago, and they brought up this same lesson plan.
Okay, so I may not have paid attention in school, but this is what they would do. They would play this show called Roots.
Right.
That's Diamond.
They would play that show, and that's how you learned the history of what was going on. No, it's really the truth.
Right.
And now that kind of stuff will outrage people. But what they did not do is they did not tell us who sold black people into slavery, because really, it was other Africans that had sold other Africans into slavery. Like, they didn't give you the details. They took a story and sensationalized it.
Right.
And that's how you learned it.
Silk remembers the lesson as well.
Mm-hmm. And then the more that they continue to play that story, Ruth, over and over and over, and more stories like that, what it did, it kept you stuck in the pain of your ancestors. You begin to believe that that's you. And that's happening to me and my people right now, even though you've never picked cotton a day in your life,
mm-hmm.
even though you was never a slave under any slave master mm-hmm. a day in your life. And that's being implemented in the new generation that they feel like, oh, I'm so in pain. I've been whipped with many stripes. And the white man is the one that's out to get me. That taught mentality.
I'd eventually come to the conclusion that slavery and the civil rights movement should not be taught to students until well after their elementary school years, because young minds simply aren't prepared to process that information without extreme negative effects on them and society as a whole. I believe it's a part of the reason why we have the racial divisions that exist today. Racism is seated in us. We're taught it, and our so-called leaders just use it to inflame the masses to retain or regain power.
Here is a love vast as the ocean, loving kindness as the flood.
So I'd like to give some friendly advice to my Black American brothers and sisters out there. I'd like to humbly tell you that to overcome the ugly legacy of slavery, you need to forgive those few dead Americans that actually own slaves. Forgive them and move on. Don't fall into the trap of victimhood created by Hollywood, the media, and our educational system. Our family was directly attacked for many years by black people within our community because of the color of our skin. We were attacked. Not our ancestors, not our grandfathers, grandfathers, grandparents. We were attacked. And yet we never held the entire black community responsible for what we endured, as our cultural elites want you to do against white Americans for slavery that you never endured. We could have easily let the victimhood mentality infect our soul. We could have blamed an entire group. We could have conflated the vicious attack against our mother with all the other neighborhood attacks on our family, even though the black man didn't attack our mom because she was white. He attacked her because he was a monster. But we could have used that as a crutch. We could have let the racism that we endured stain our view of the world. But we didn't. We let go of the terrorizing and the pain and the anger and the fear and chalked it up to just a series of bad apples. To my brothers and sisters out there, many of us Hispanics and whites and Asians also know what it's like to be the minority.
When you look at me and you see this Caucasian woman, a minority looked at me and said, she would never know what I've had to go through. But I know what that feels like to be the minority.
It's time to let go of the pain of your ancestors, because holding on to that ugly history only allows opportunists to exploit that pain seated in you at a very young age. And they'll continue to use it not to help you in your everyday life. They'll use it for their own personal gain.
I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by Patrick Carelci and me, Adriana Cortez, for Inform Ventures. To purchase Red Pilled America's first ever book, Awakenings, please visit redpilledamerica.com and click on the book at the top of the page. Thanks for listening.
Empower on me without measure, full and boundless, drawing out my heart to thee. Who is love will not remember, who can cease to sing his praise. He can never be forgotten throughout heaven's eternal days.